Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley program, brought to you by the Oshman Family JCC in Palo Alto. My name is Stephen Leckart, correspondent for Wired Magazine. It is my pleasure to introduce Dr. Sebastian Thrun, Google Fellow and the CEO and co-founder of Udacity, the online private education organization. Dr. Thrun is a robotics systems expert and former professor and director of the Artificial Intelligence Laboratory at Stanford University. He received his Ph.D. in computer science and statistics from the University of Bonn and later served as an assistant professor and co-director of the Robot Learning Laboratory at Carnegie Mellon University. Dr. Thrun joined Stanford in 2003, where he led the development of the robotic car Stanley that won the 2005 DARPA Grand Challenge. 2 years later, his robot Junior won second place in the DARPA Urban Challenge. Since 2007, he's been working with Google to develop a number of projects, including Google Street View, Google's self-driving car, and Google Glass. Dr. Thrun has been named one of the Brilliant Five by Popular Science, the fifth most creative person in business by Fast Company, and one of the 50 smartest people in tech by Fortune magazine. He has received the Career Award from the National Science Foundation, the Max Planck Research Award, and the American Ingenuity Award in Education by the Smithsonian. Last year, he co-founded Udacity after 160,000 students in 190 countries signed up to take his free online artificial intelligence class at Stanford. Full disclosure, I'm one of those students, and I had not taken a math class since high school. So while I'm not exactly proud of the grade I received, I am proud to have finished. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Dr. Sebastian Thrun.
Two years ago, I had the pleasure to attend a talk by one of my heroes, Salman Khan, of Khan Academy fame. I was teaching at Stanford. I was a proud teacher of typically 200 students that would show up to my class just to listen to a hedge fund manager who was reaching tens of millions of students using YouTube. So I went home a little depressed, thinking, wow, what impact could I have if I moved out of Stanford's walls into the open world? I called up my co-instructor, Peter Novick, a Google engineer, and we decided to put our artificial intelligence class that was scheduled for the fall online. The plan unrolled by a single email that we sent to a distribution list of about 1,000 that announced Stanford would open up its artificial intelligence graduate class free of charge for the world to take, and students would be given the same exams and homework assignments so they could compare themselves. As we did this, we asked ourselves the question, how many students would sign up? How many people in the world actually care about graduate-level artificial intelligence? The guesses ranged between 500 and 5,000, and me being the eternal optimist, I put my mark at 10,000. That was Friday afternoon. Saturday morning, I woke up to a text message that had a number around 5,000. It grew to 7,000 in the afternoon. Sunday morning, we reached 10,000 students. Monday morning, when the mark hit 14,000, Stanford administrators came back to work and realized that Stanford was praised all over the blogosphere for their fantastic deed that I had forgotten to tell them at the time. A number of meetings with my dean followed, at which point we agreed to continue the class. And as the weeks went on, not only did two other professors open up their classes, Andrew Ng and Jennifer Widom, but also we reached 160,000 students. So here I was, having educated 200 students at a time, by all means a successful Stanford educator, having to teach 160,000. I had absolutely no clue how to do this. No technology, no team. So we struggled in the next month and built up a platform, delivered video classes online. We tried to be innovative, not just on the delivery of the class itself, but also on the type teachings. We replaced lectures by quizzes and by little small video game kind of elements. And when the class launched, we really had a classroom of 160,000 on day one, 80,000 on day two. And as the class went on, we had 23,000 students finish at Stanford level quality. 23,000 students in artificial intelligence is more than all other professors in the world teach combined every year. It was unbelievable. But even more unbelievable were the type of people that signed up for this class. Most of them weren't your typical Stanford students. We had people in Africa, in Ghana, in Afghanistan on the battlefield. We had 80, 90 years old. We had 8-year-olds. People of all trades in life. People who never had access to high-quality education before. People who wrote me really heartbreaking emails how this new medium and this new class was changing their lives, even though it was clear they would never be able to leverage any of the skills I gave them in this class. It became a mass movement. 1,950 people volunteered to translate this class into a total of 44 languages. The class was taken in 195 countries, pretty much any place except for North Korea. There was a person who started a counter class called Artistic Intelligence that echoed the classes we taught in the field of arts. Hundreds and hundreds of physical meetups of people collected and met and studied together. It became literally a mass movement. I could move or travel to any country on this planet, and after a certain number of minutes, someone would recognize me and say, "You're Professor Fun, I'm one of your students." I was always inclined to say, "Yes, I know you're from class." When that happened, I realized we are beginning a phase shift in education. My own students on campus that had paid upwards of $40,000 a year to see the famous professor chose to stay away from class and preferred me on video. So the number of class attendants went down from about 200 to roughly 30 students. And for the midterm, they all came in and the classroom was packed. I said, "Where are you guys?" And they said, "You know what? Your class is at 9 in the morning. We're still asleep. We prefer you in our dorm. I mean, in video." Midterm came along, and I was shocked that the score of the students have gone up compared to previous midterms I taught by a full letter grade. I was shocked because I'm a really good professor. I'm also good looking. I couldn't fathom that what I did in class was not the best possible thing a professor could do. It hadn't occurred to me that a nodding group of students is not necessarily indicating to me that they really learned the material, neither that they would know they learned the material, and that a well-procured set of exercises and mini lectures online could do a better job than I could do in class. And when I stacked ranked all the students in the end, and I put together into a big spreadsheet my 200 Stanford students and my 23,000 surviving online students, number 1 to number 412 were online. And the best performing Stanford student was number 413. That was a shock. Stanford had accidentally failed to admit 412 students that obviously performed better than every single Stanford student in this class. There must be a huge number of people out there that don't make it into Stanford, and they should make it into Stanford, that are excluded from the privilege of higher education. When that happened, I realized my life was changing. I've been a professor all my life. I've worked at Google. And often students come to me and say, "Professor, what should I do? What job did I take? How do I find a good job? And I always tell them the same thing. You don't pick your job. Your job picks you. Little did I know that in my middle-aged life, the moment would occur where my job picked me. And I had to become an educator, but an educator in the new world of online education, and not an educator in the old world of classroom education, which I still believe has a strong value, but for one reason or another, ended up not exciting me as much. Fast forward, we've started a company called Udacity. Several companies were started at the time. Another one is called Coursera by colleagues of mine, Daphne Koller and Andrew Ring. MIT started a company called MITx. It was renamed to edX when Harvard joined. MIT and Harvard endowed it with $60 million. The University of Virginia president was contemplating joining the online train. One of her professors was working for me at the time. When she wasn't moving fast enough, she was fired and later reinstantiated. That sent shockwaves through the world. And I was busy perfectionating this new medium and thinking about how we can bring education to the entire world and democratize it. June last year, I wake up, an email in my inbox. My name is Jerry. What's your phone number? I send him my phone number. 5 minutes later, my phone rings. Say, hey, my name is Jerry Brown. I'm your governor. Say, I'm Sebastian. I'm your citizen. What can I do for you, sir? Jerry Brown had read about me in a newspaper article. And he's been in pain, I should say, about the state of the California higher education system. So we started talking about the situation as he saw it, and to me was new because I've always lived in the Stanford world and I never moved at the community college world. But in California, we have 472,000 waitlisted students that are completely willing and eager to engage in education and pay for it, but that can't get in because we just don't have the funds to supply the classes. In the California State University System, almost 60% of the incoming students, 60% of the students fail the entrance exam, ill-prepared for college, and they go into something called remedial education. And remedial tastes as bad as it sounds. You pay full tuition, you earn no college credit, you have a year to fix your remedial skills, otherwise you're out and declare unfit for college, which means unfit for a career that you aspire to have. And even among those that make it and that get into their classes, California students tend to take 6 years for a four-year degree and 4 years for a two-year degree. The sheer number of retakes, which in the CSU, the California State System, exceeds 40,000 a year, is enormous. And the money spent just on students failing and retaking the same class is as much as it would take to fund an entire campus of the CSU system. So after I've learned about these numbers, we decided to get active in a space where we could hopefully help California and California students the most. We put together a coalition of accreditors, WASC, which is the accreditation agency for colleges, unions, most notably the CFA, California Faculty Association, the CSU, in particular San Jose State University, Mo Koyam and Alan Jun, who are really amazing people, their president and provost, Sacramento, the lieutenant governor, the governor, and various others, and started brainstorming how can we take this new instrument, this amazing online vehicle, and leverage it to go to the California people. This January, we started a pilot that actually, when it was announced, Governor Brown showed up in person to bring online education at an affordable price point to California high school students to enhance college readiness. And the pilot is small. It's only three classes. And the number of students are small. We only admitted 300 as opposed to 300,000. But it's all set up for scale. And in this pilot, we teach remedial students remedial math. We teach students statistics. We get them credits they can take all the way to the UC system if they wish. And we advise them, we mentor them, we shepherd them for the program, and we build for success. And we do this at a price point that is exactly 10% of what these classes cost in the CSU system. Why 10%? Well, our nation has an insurmountable burden in college debt. You can read about this every day in the newspapers. College debt is now above $1 trillion. It's exceeding credit card debt and car debt and mortgage debt. It's this number one liability. It's in the way of people's independence and they're fulfilling their dreams. So it's time to leverage technology to reduce the cost of college. But more important than the cost is the quality and the reach. So in enlisting students, we specifically reached out to inner city schools, such as Oakland Military Institute, which has over 50 students in the system, mostly black kids, kids that have a very small chance to get into college. And we give them a chance to place themselves better in college through these classes and to hopefully avoid remediation when they enter college. But that's just the beginning. We also worked intensely with companies that knocked on our door and said, look, you should know past college there's a problem. When our college graduates come and interview and take a job, they often don't have the right job skills. Now, why is that? If college is a space to acquire the right job skills, how come then when our graduates come out, companies complain about lack of job skills? And the answer is subtle but really important. It has to do with impedance mismatch. In my field of technology, we see a turnover about every 5 years. Every 5 years, all technologies change. If you're a programmer, you have to know Ruby on Rails, iOS, which is iPhone programming for those of you who aren't programmers, Android programming, big data. Most of these things didn't exist 5 years ago. Universities turn over as professors every 35 years. It's about the time it takes between hiring a professor and retiring a professor. And therein lies the problem, the ability for academia to adjust to the pace of society. Now the society is ever faster moving, it's just not given. So we started working with a number of companies actually sponsoring us, like Google, NVIDIA. NVIDIA was actually the first. Autodesk, Mathematica, Microsoft, that put up content on our site so people can get job training skills necessary for entering the workforce. Now, where does it lead us, and what can we say about education at large? I want to use this wonderful opportunity to be speaking at the Commonwealth Club, which I adore and religiously listen to give some more general reflections about the state of higher education in this country and what should happen going forward. Higher education is a field that has moved less than most other fields. In fact, more slowly than government, more slowly than military. If you look at higher education, the way higher education is delivered today is about the same as 50 years ago and about the same as 500 years ago. There's been no brand shift in higher education in the last 50 years. The big names today are just about the same big names we had 50 years ago. No other field you could point to that wouldn't have a brand shift within 50 years. It's the single slowest moving aspect of society. Now, the predominant mode of education, the way it exists today, despite the fact that there's a lot of experimentation on the ground, but the predominant mode of education was invented before the book was invented. Before the book was invented, it was the most economical form to put knowledge from one brain to another brain by having a person talk to another person synchronously at the same time because there were no recording devices. Of course, at the time, it was known, just like today, that people learn at different speeds. So the most economical way of doing this, pair a certain number of students with a professor and have the professor lecture those students. And while lecturing is not that popular in humanities, in my field of sciences and engineering, it's the predominant mode of education. Now, going forward, things were invented like television and movies and so on that all looked like promising for education. But none of them changed the fundamental paradigm, not even PowerPoint. It's still a paradigm where we pair in real time, live, an instructor and a group of students. Now, from this synchronicity come a number of consequences. We all know that people learn at different paces. People blank out. People have different questions. People have different motivations. And by forcing a cohort of people to move at the same pace, we have to do two things. We have to select them very carefully to fit together so that they hopefully think at approximately the same speed and the same capability. But we also want to make the class size as small as possible. So the instructor is given the ability to adjust to questions that come up. And therein lies the major problem of education. Small class sizes work better. It's been proven 20 years ago by a guy named Benjamin Bloom in a paper called The Two Sigma Effect that the class size of one works the best, called mentoring, because then the instructor can really work most intensely with the student and react to the student the most. But small classes are also uneconomical. How can a class of 160,000 ever be a good experience under that logic? And the answer is amazingly simple. It's asynchronicity. It's the ability to go at your own pace. And there's nothing new here. Sal Khan has exploited this fact for a long time. In fact, in his talk that I listened to, he pointed out his nieces, who coincidentally also preferred him on tape over the real Sal Khan, did so because they could just watch him twice or 30 times without being embarrassed. Try that in the physical classroom. Raise your hand for the 30th time. Say, "Professor, I want to see that again." By going at your own speed, you can adjust to a person. And why stop there? If you can go at your own speed, you can also make the content more interactive. You can wait for a student to get the thing right. You can wait with assessment. There's no need why December 23rd or 14th is like exam day and you force everybody into the same exam with anxiety. Now, it turns out there are learning systems in the world that do just that. You go at your own speed, you take your own time, you learn by problem solving, and you enjoy them. You enjoy them so much that some of you spend more time in those learning environments than in classrooms. They're called video games. Video games have constant assessment, afford you any time you want, give you multiple choices, give you instant feedback on how you performed, and many of us get hooked on the boost that we get by answering a question correctly and mastering a challenge. To me, video games are just amazing learning environments. If I think about Angry Birds as an example, Angry Birds, of course, teaches you physics. It teaches you wrong physics. When you actually dial in, you realize there's like lots of physical laws are being violated. But they teach you something. And they teach you the skill of what it means to, I guess in this case, to kill pigs with birds and slingshots. But you learn about dynamics, you learn about how impact works, how collision, how forces work in some abstract way. I always think that the only problem with Angry Birds, I would love to just make Angry Birds the national education vehicle number one, if it wouldn't just stop with Angry Birds, but it would go on and teach you physics more abstractly and let you solve equations and so on. But the interesting difference to higher education today, to Angry Birds, is comes along, and to really show the absurdity of some of the stuff we do in the classroom, is if you were to bring back Angry Birds into a physical classroom, ask how would I at Stanford teach Angry Birds? Well, the very first class would be about a lecture on, like, here's the learning objectives, and here's my office hours, and here are the TAs. You're going to sit through this for 45 minutes. And then the second class would be the history of Angry Birds, because you have to be aware of the history of Angry Birds. And in the third class, I might give you the privilege of watching you, me, of you watching me playing Angry Birds, because part of our education is that I show you that I'm smarter than you are, so I show you how I do it, and eventually give you a homework assignment and say, solve it for yourself. How downturning is this? Let's go further. All of you learn all the time. You learn all the time. The biggest revolution in learning is actually not my company or anyone else's company. I would submit it's Google and it's Wikipedia. We now learn on demand when we need it. And let me just give you some examples of where you might have learned something recently. You might have refinanced a house. You might have done some research on a product. You might have learned about what is a good vacation spot. You might have done all kinds of stuff where you go in and learn something. You do it on demand, and you can find the information at your fingertips. That, to me, is a great learning experience. It is so profoundly different from the way we organize education, where we are obsessed with curating the exact sequence and the exact path and the exact timing which students have to learn. So for a true revolution to take place, we have to be able to take learning out of the extremely curated world, where we believe we can predict up to the day which kid has to be at what math level, exactly at what time, and bring it back to the playful level, where we connect to people's motivations and let people experience learning and go at their own pace. When I say at their own pace, we have some amazing success stories. In October last year, Time magazine ran a cover on us, and it picked a class that a 25-year-old staff member in my company taught on physics, Andy Brown. I should say they picked that class even though my own class was also online. His was better. And in this class was an 11-year-old girl from Pakistan taking effectively a college-level physics class. She was competing with her brother, her twin brother, also 11 years old, who could finish this class faster. You don't think of 11-year-old girls taking college classes and exceeding, excelling in those in this country. We pre-plan exactly what math level kids have to take at that grade. But the world is full of miraculous people, fast and slow people. And if we get into their speed, into their learning speed and capabilities, we were so much more successful than we regulate everything and prescribe every single step along the way. We had a pilot in Texas by a charter school set up specifically for kids that were flushed out of other schools because of the academic performance. This is a side effect of the No Child Left Behind Act. It's long been recognized that the way to improve the score of your school is to get rid of the poor performing students. So this charter school collected only those students that were performing under the 70% mark for years. And the headmaster of that school decided to run a pilot where 24 of their students took our classes. And two of them finished a college-level class in 2 weeks. Both girls, both 17 years old, and both in physics. So we were like flabbergasted. How would that happen? So we flew down there and met the girls. It turns out both of them didn't fit. One was extremely noisy. And you could just see in any classroom, she'd just be the person you don't want to have there. And one was extremely quiet. The type of person would never raise their voice if they didn't understand anything. So the moment that something goes wrong in the communication, she'd be lost, and there was no way to catch up. In the privacy of the online medium, being able to take their time without the embarrassment of other people watching, sometimes watching videos 30 times in a row to really get the point home, learning for mastery, not for fixed timing, they found new hope in learning. And it turned out these two girls were plenty smart. They were really plenty smart. They would have failed in their careers had they stayed on the school system the way it exists. But they drew new hope for college from this experience. That's the real power of learning. That's what we're after. We want to really transform society. And while I'm at it, I also want to address the state of higher education in this country. We are the marvel of the world. We have the best higher education system. We've done a phenomenal job tying together research, brilliance, and higher education. But we also have a higher education system that's exceedingly expensive and exceedingly exclusive. I myself, if I applied at Harvard today, I would not get in as an undergrad. I don't fit the demographics. And most of us don't. Exclusivity comes from a thriving to be the best. The quality of students graduating from our top colleges is obviously gated by how good the students are going in and how much value the university adds. In any manufacturing industry, by the way, if you thought of teaching and education as manufacturing, when you assess the effectiveness of a manufacturing pipeline, you look at the difference between the student coming in, or the good coming in, and the good going out as the value added. But strangely, in education, we don't do this. We just look at the value of the good coming out. So what many universities have identified as the best way to optimize the quality of the students coming out is to just let the best students in. So there's this eternal competition for the best students. And very often, education, in my opinion, falls by the wayside. It falls by the wayside when you go into a class and there's 500 kids listening to a single professor. It's completely obvious to me that it's falling by the wayside. There's no way that this could be a meaningful learning experience. Also, it falls by the wayside when the rankings of colleges never look at the actual delta administered by the university education, but only at the total outcome and the research credentials. We've become complacent about the quality of education. That is not to say that a lot of innovation takes place. A lot of teachers mean insanely well. But as a system, we become complacent. We also become complacent about costs. Educational costs have gone up an average of 7.4% for the last 30 years. That is way ahead of inflation. And there's no end in sight. So what I really care about and I really want to achieve is a change. I want to bring back the American in American higher education. This is a country which most of all is defined by trust in the individual and the power of the individual. When we are at our best, we trust ourselves. We trust the people. We give them the freedom to execute. We want to get back to that in education. We want to trust our students, give them their own paths, and go their own speed, and become more efficient about how we reach them, more inventive, try out more things, and really understand how to fix the education system and make it better. That's the calling that Governor Brown had into me and that I've been following to the present day. For me, it's in the beginning of a journey. I can't claim of all the solutions. We are certainly working on it. We are running experiments. But it's been a fascinating journey. And when all is said and done, I hope to get to a point where every kid in the world has access to great education. Education becomes affordable, personal, becomes lifelong, so you can continue to educate yourself over the entire lifetime, and becomes more fun than is often today. Thank you.
All right. So thanks, Sebastian. And before we get to your questions, and there's a huge pile in my hands, I'd like to begin kind of with something a little bit specific to my experience, because unlike probably most of the people in this room, I've taken one of your classes, and I took the first one. And what was so, I think, interesting about the first one was that it was such an experiment, and I think even the students felt that it was an experiment. You could kind of see when things weren't working. There were servers that were crashing. I think there were 3 DOS attacks on the server. And it made for kind of a wild ride, unlike a typical class where everything is sort of prim and proper. But for you, you know, here's my question. A lot of the students wound up pitching in to help out. They built, little patches of software. They built online quizzes to kind of make the course better. How does that level of engagement sort of factor into what you're doing now with Udacity?
So we have a huge number of students that really help each other. In addition to the educational medium, we have very rich discussion forums. And often we have something like 20, 30, 40,000 students at the same time active. And very frequently, someone has a controversial question. We made a mistake in the way we curated the materials, what have you. That someone raises that question within seconds of the problem coming up, and others within minutes respond. I've had instances where I was unclear in my teachings, and someone else wrote almost like a conference paper size, 8 pages of a detailed explanation, beautifully written, what I intended to say. And then students by the hundreds would say, thank you so much, that is so great. Now I understand what the professor meant.
You're smiling, but that does, as a professor, does that undermine your authority?
It's exactly the opposite. If I am successful, I make my students active participants. In fact, I turn them into educators. Then I'm successful.
How do you build kind of infrastructure to encourage that, or is it just wild and chaotic and does it do its own thing?
I think to the present point, it's still pretty wild and chaotic, and we are learning what the right modes are. We find that there's hundreds of groups of people right now meeting up physically to build physical study groups. We've actually encouraged a good amount of it. We encourage, of course, student interaction. When we get students into jobs, one of the things we do is job placement. We find that the interactive social skills to assist other students are better indicators of success in the job market than the hard academic numbers that we get out of our exams. And we really see this kind of synergy between students. And it's great to give education back to the students. I think that every student should be a teacher and every teacher should be a student at the same time. And in this online medium, you can play with this. It's really breaking all the rules of digital classrooms.
What kind of job placement are you doing? What kind of students you've been finding, and where are you placing them?
We had an interesting class called CS 101 where we taught, and it's still online, you can take it right now, where you can learn from zero programming skills. When you take this class, you can build your own Google. Not the full Google, not Google Reader, but you can build a primitive search engine, and it goes out and spiders the web and searches for you. And in the end, we had a competition, and two students submitted a video search engine that I ran by Google, and I guess I'm radio here, I should be careful what I say, but many people believe it was much, much better than YouTube. So some of the talent is really kind of surprising, people you would never pick up based on their CV, but when you see their projects, it's really amazing. We place them, we have about 350 partner companies, big companies, small companies, we circulate CVs. We have partnerships, I guess NVIDIA is in the room, Kalisa, with various companies that actually sponsored us, sponsored classes that we give CVs back to in exchange and so on.
Well, and was that in the vision from the beginning that you would be finding potentially great candidates all over the world?
Yeah, and we've been experimenting with this. We had some mixed successes. Some of our students spend all their time in online classes, and if you take 15 of those, it's not a great predictor for hiring success.
Why not?
Because you send a message that you have nothing else to do but take classes. So a good balanced work life, class taking life is actually more advisable. But be it as it is, what I'm very proud of is that some of the people we've discovered are people you would never ever find in traditional mediums. They would never get admitted to Stanford.
And what's the sort of distribution about where they are in the world, if you know?
It's roughly a third, a third, a third. A third North America, a third Europe, and a third rest of the world.
Is that what you would have expected?
Kind of. Very positive is India. India is very, very strong. Brazil is very strong. We're using YouTube as a video engine, and YouTube is banned in China. As a result, there's only a few thousand students in China, but still more than we have ever seen in Stanford in my classes.
Does that, I mean, for your, you know, the students you used to teach at Stanford who would come to you and say, you know, how do I find a job, does this, I don't know, does it undermine what they're doing? Does it make it tougher for them? And what do you tell those students?
I guess if we are really successful in fostering the world's talent and not just the Ivy League's talent, I think it's not going to undermine people's jobs. It's going to be the opposite. It's going to increase the rate of innovation. I mean, you could have argued in the beginning of the industrial revolution that we should stop building technology because it's going to jeopardize the jobs of farmers. But the truth is, we've all become more busy and more engaged as a result and have more interesting jobs. I actually firmly believe it's really important to democratize education, not just keep it locked up in small places.
So, you know, you've always said that Stanford will always be Stanford, right? Harvard will always be Harvard. What's going to happen with the tier of schools that are below that and maybe the tier of schools that are below that?
It's an often asked question, and I my favorite answer is just to punt on it, because it's a really complicated question. Our activities right now, we try to reach to people who are outside the existing college system. So, for example, by making high school kids college ready, we conceivably can reduce the time in college, but that would really result in more kids making it through college. And as I gave you the California numbers in the beginning, there's such a shortage of ability to go to college that everybody seems to be completely happy with the vision we're just going to bring more kids to college.
And do you see it, I mean, if it's a supplement, do you see it ever sort of being a replacement?
Is cinema, movies a replacement for theater? I don't think so. I mean, people still go into theaters, and it's a very different experience, and it costs more. It has a different... I mean, do people stop going to ball games because it's on television? Nope. People still go to ball games. In fact, ball games have become a much broader audience since they got on television, and the ticket prices have gone up, not down, as a result. I think there's going to be a nice complement. I think what we'll see is there's a lot of... I mean, first of all, there's a lot of bad teaching in colleges. I think bad teaching will be harder going in the future because we're going to publicize more and open this up more, which I think is good for the students in the world. But then there's a need for physical campuses. There's a need for physical interaction. We're here together tonight in this room for a reason. And that physical interaction need will remain. I think what will happen is we will be able to make better use of that physical interaction. So, for example, one of our instructors is Steve Blank, who's a world-famous entrepreneur, and he used to teach a semester-long class at Princeton and Berkeley and other places. And now he's been able to condense it to a much smaller, by taking all this kind of boring stuff that students should know that's very repetitive into the online world, and then reserving the in-face time for something much more intense and much more focused.
So one of the reasons why this scales extremely well and why it's actually a favorite for certain professors is that you pre-record all your lesson plans and your materials, and that once that semester is done, you can rerun the course next semester with, you know, a fraction of the work, which is, I think, a professor's dream. It's probably everybody's dream.
I'm teaching right now.
Exactly. Exactly. But so...
I'm teaching statistics and AI and robotics at the same time.
And for those listening in on the radio, he's just sitting in a chair. And he's not even looking at a phone. But no, in all seriousness, I mean, materials, if you're teaching art history, that subject doesn't change much, you know. But if you're working in sciences or math or some of these more, you know, these fields that really are, you know, research is constantly coming out, are we at a danger that professors are just going to get lazy and pull their plug-and-play lessons off the shelf and, you know, not update the materials?
I mean, I've met one or two lazy professors in my life, even in physical classrooms, and I'm sure some of the audience have encountered lazy professors. They exist. I think what's going to happen is for online classes in particular, because they're very open, there'll be a good amount of competition for who teaches the better class. I had my own moment of dismay when I put up my statistics class, and it was online in the open. I had only 50,000 students. And a statistics professor anonymously posted a blog post about it. It was 7 pages long, and he called it shockingly awful. And to make matters worse, he didn't just say shockingly awful. He went point after point after point why this class was just really, really, really bad against every pedagogical insight and just completely disaligned with statistics. And while I didn't like his review and I didn't agree with all the points, I did like that he could critique me. They could see what I was doing, and he could start a debate. And others came in and to my rescue and said, no, this professor is wrong. We see this differently. And I don't know if I'm right. It might have been a lousy class. But the fact that we can have a debate now about how good is this class and we can improve it, that's a big deal. Like, if you could just open all the classes and see which ones are the best, I think the students would benefit greatly. And related to this is our ability to change the class. So since this review came out, there were actually 2 or 3 points I agreed with, I hate to admit. We changed the content accordingly and fixed it. And that's something I can do when it's in there forever. I can actually use data to do the same thing. I can study, and I do study data intensely, of how these classes perform, which means I can take the art of teaching from this medieval, like he said, you see, said kind of set of like druidic like recipes into a data-driven science, where the science is being conducted every time a student takes a class. And that itself is very exciting to me.
Now, yeah, I mean, you teach science, and you're a very data-driven person. For subjects, let's say art history, which I mentioned, do you envision this model kind of scaling in that direction as well? I mean, even also from a testing perspective, you know, things that are, it's easy to quantify a bunch of true and false questions. It's much more difficult to go through and grade an essay. I mean, where is this headed?
I mean, first of all, we've been sticking with STEM, science, technology, and education, mathematics, because we can more mechanize the feedback to student, and we actually believe immediate feedback is really important for this. But others have really tried classes in philosophy and arts and so on, and they've sometimes used peer grading with more or less success, depending how it's set up, as a way to provide feedback. I should also say we are currently teaching classes that do involve essay writing, and we just hire people to grade them. It actually doesn't take much work to grade an essay, to be honest. If you look at the economics of higher education, you'd be hard-pressed to find classes where your instructors spend more than 3 hours of personal time per student. Isn't that much time, even if you pay $5,000 for it. But the truth is we still have to experiment. We still have to learn how to do this right. And I'm personally shying away from, say, philosophy, which really involves a lot of oral discourse because our computers are like really dumb in comparison to what is required. Whereas for mathematical equations, they're really smart. They're really easy to grade or computer code. But as this goes forward, I'm sure we're going to find ways to make this work.
Well, if your goal is to get people jobs, philosophy is probably not a top priority as it is.
Well, I would teach it differently.
Yeah, you probably would. I'm swimming in a bunch of questions from the audience. You know, this is actually a really good one. I see two problems with taking exams remotely, proving identity and proving students are not cheating. What solutions are there, and more importantly, do they scale?
Yes, so first of all, we have solutions. It's called proctoring. Proctoring occurs in two ways. One is in-person proctoring. We're working with a partner company. There's about 4,500 testing centers around the world. We can go pay a little bill and then have a personal proctor exam. This is at the level where government authorization and government tests are being proctored. And then there's a thriving business industry that we partner with on online proctoring, where you show your ID and you're being monitored on the computer screen. It's not entirely safe, but it's pretty safe. But my real answer is I think we are a little bit too obsessed with cheating, and we often drag the dog by its tail by putting big barriers in against cheating. The vast majority of students doesn't cheat. And in our classes, there's things you can cheat on, maybe the final exam, but if every single interaction, every quiz you cheat, if you're so smart to find a way to cheat around like thousands of quizzes, you know what? You deserve the credit in my books. And if you're even so smart, you hire somebody that does all the discussion forum stuff for you and helps all the other students, you should be a manager. It's great. I mean, you're successful in life. So, I mean, the final word is out there, but I think in the end of the day, as we transform examination from this thing called summative examination, where at the end of a class we do this one big boom and you can fail or succeed, into what's called formative assessment, where examination becomes your friend, do people cheat playing Angry Birds? They don't, right? They really crave for the success, for the achievement of getting to the next level. When you connect to those feelings that you crave to get to the next level, to prove to yourself you can do it, you know what? Cheat and you lose.
So this actually plays off of one of the other questions that someone in here had, which is the idea of gamification and building in sort of incentives and you know, a point system. How important is that, do you think, to this model and where it's headed? Maybe it's not Angry Birds, but for the time being, how does that factor in?
So I think it's huge. I'm not saying games are the solution for everything, but it's also an attitude question. If I go to any educator and ask, like, what about if kids play a game in your class? Let's say I hate it. Kids have to deliver their cell phones in the entrance because we don't want this technology stuff in our classroom. And to me, it's exactly the opposite of the learnings they should be having. They should say, wow, kids care about this stuff. How can I make my class as attractive as a video game so they're going to watch my class rather than playing a video game? That's the day we succeed. We should completely embrace technology. And a lot of it's cultural. Educators tend not to be technologists. It's very rare that you find an educator who's a technologist. It's usually the opposite. Almost every study I see shows how bad technology is, despite the fact that kids just love it and love to learn it and learn much faster than any other medium. So games might not be the right solution. I'm using games as a way to provoke people's thinking. Obviously, Angry Birds is not the right solution. SimCity is more of a right solution. You actually learn something interesting. But the fun that you draw from it, from this new technology, is insanely powerful. I have a, you know this, you have a five-year-old son, and he was able to operate the iPad before he was doing anything else. In fact, before he spoke, before he crawled, he was able to flip pages. There's this funny moment where he went to a magazine and tried to push it, and nothing happened. He felt the magazine was broken. There is power to this. There's power to interaction. And people crave this interaction. We should just be honest about it and then use the best of this interaction best back into our classrooms and our teachings.
So, you know, this is actually a good question. You know, you mentioned earlier that when you did the first class, the retention rate was, you know, fairly low. I mean, you're already dealing with a very large number, but, you know, what efforts are being made by Udacity to retain the number of students who sign up online?
Yeah, so the Achilles heel of this massive open online course movement, or MOOCs as they're called, is that the retention rates are low. And they're being debated. There's arguments for or against it, but typically a class that starts with 20,000 students might have 200, 300, 500 finishers, maybe 1,000 finishers. And that's across the different providers and platforms. We've actually taken this to heart when we went into classes like remedial classes and gateway classes in college, saying that any education solution that only carries 3% of the kids is probably not a great solution. And we did something that's actually fairly common in online education, just not in this MOOC world. We added people. We added mentors that sit there and shepherd kids through the program. And while I'm in no position to disclose the data of the ongoing pilot with San Jose State, one of the numbers that we probably disclosed quite a bit is that we managed in one of our classes to draw a retention from about 3% as this open free MOOC up to 100% by adding people and adding credit, college credit. And that's actually a very promising sign for us. These are the signals we look for. We're looking for the magic educational formula, the kind of the holy grail of education that makes retention go up and learning outcomes go up and is scalable so we can keep it, the cost low.
So it's blended learning, essentially.
Yeah, it's some sort of blended learning, yeah.
So it's not one replacing the other, it's a hybrid. This is a softball followed by not so much of a softball. What is the origin of the company name Udacity, followed by how is the company funded?
The Udacity name came along because he was scrambling for a name just the night before a public announcement, and Audacity.com was taken, whereas Udacity.com was still available. And we felt there was a nice ring to it because you're working with universities and we're doing education for you. In Europe, we often call it the Udacity because they don't know what Audacity is. we're still educating our students, ourselves. We are venture funded. We are a for-profit company. We're often called a social venture. I've been on tape that I said we are proudly for-profit. We actually make no profit at all. But we believe that it's actually good to align interests of people. The people in my company often work 80-hour weeks, day and night, and they really are insanely enthusiastic about solving education. I actually believe if people work really hard and they manage to establish good business models and do good education, they deserve a kickback.
Have you hired anyone from one of your MOOCs?
Yeah, about 18 people or so, 15 people.
That are working in the company today.
Yeah. And the people we hire, actually not the people who score well on the exams. The people we hire are the people in the discussion forums who empower other people. Every employer knows this. If you have a choice between the super smart kid that can't work with anybody or someone who's reasonably smart but empowers others, you pick the latter because no problem ever gets solved in isolation. They always get solved in teams.
That's big. Do you expect to see a standalone accredited MOOC university in the next 2 to 3 years?
There's a lot of debate about accreditation right now, and accreditation has its own set of problems, and it's very hard to see where this goes. But obviously, with the work we're doing with San Jose State, where we're really gearing up at some point to admit thousands of students to a single class, it has that element. We are not a university. We don't seek accreditation. We see our role much more working around university, before university, after university. We actually believe in universities, and we are there to help. But the basic formula of this massive online education, when it's really worked out, I think can be scaled even to an entire degree program.
And how does, we were talking before about this a bit, but how does continuing education factor into it? Aside from just a four-year degree or taking a few classes here or there, what does this mean for sort of adults who are already in the workforce?
It's actually really good news, and a huge number of our students, so to speak, in Udacity are working professionals aged 25 to 35. It's the most common age group that we have right now. The reason why this is a great solution for those people is if you look at college today, because of physical presence requirements, it occupies a singular slice in your life, typically between age, say, 19 or 18 and 25, what have you, plus minus. And after that, most universities really don't do a good job educating people. Now, that model was a very legitimate model, say, 300 years ago. 300 years ago, the day you were born and the day you died, not much happened. So a single slice of education probably got you everything there is to know. But today, the world has changed, and there's a huge gap, especially for people mid-career, to be able to keep up with the technical skills. And more of those come to Udacity. So an example is our class by NVIDIA, where we teach parallel programming together with NVIDIA on a platform of their GPUs and a framework called CUDA. That's a field that didn't exist 10 years ago. And if you got a degree 10 years ago, you would have no clue how to deal with this. But today, if you do graphics programming or computer vision programming and do this efficiently, these are the skills you need. So it's very, very common now that professionals come to us, take these classes, get a certificate, bring it back to their employers, or when they apply for new jobs and present them, and get hired on those certificates.
And, you know, I think if you work for a company like Google or if you work in the Valley, obviously a certificate from Udacity is terrific. But if you work abroad and it's Udacity for the time being, you know, how are employers going to start to sort of understand what these certificates mean and how to sort of weigh their employees' value based on that?
It's interesting. I found, and when it comes to higher education, more resistance among the students than among the employers in the following sense. When I talk to employers and say, look, we have certificates, people certify these skills, I have yet to find an employer that worries about proctored exams and cheating. And by and large, these certificates are being accepted face value. They don't replace a degree, especially when you go to the Fortune 500 type companies, the bigger companies, Google. They require degrees. If you go to very small startup companies, they often don't care about degrees at all anymore. It's all about GitHub and coding skills. And there, these certificates carry a lot of value. Where I see the big obstacle for this to become mainstream is on the customer side, on the student side. When you think about trying something new, right, trying a new restaurant and the food is bad, not a big deal, pick a different one next evening. Buying a new cell phone, you know what? You're stuck with it for a year, some regret, but you can overcome it. Buying a new house, well, if you make a mistake, big deal, you might actually lose your money. Getting the wrong education, you have to believe in multiple lives to recover. So for anybody to say, I'm going to give up my wonderful existing degree in education for this new thing is an enormous risk. And because it's a once-in-a-lifetime type of thing, getting a higher education, I see a lot of signals that being within the four-credit system, degree system is actually really important. And that's one of the obstacles to face for us as a company to make sure we do this, handle this really well. And we are insanely fortunate to have a number of partner universities that are willing to offer our classes or classes on our platform that they, of course, teach for credit and for degrees.
And as a for-profit company, I mean, how are you planning to make money?
Our recipe right now is that we have promised to the world that everything is available for free. If you just want to learn, come to our site. We are as free as Google is free and Facebook is free. But if you care about services like mentoring services and you care about proctored exam that all the way lead to credit, we charge a fee. And the fee right now is set with San Jose State at $150, so it's relatively low. It competes well with community colleges. But we take that money back to the student. We take it back in terms of mentoring services and proctoring services. And we keep a very small slice of this money for ourselves.
Well, hopefully not too small a slice.
Right now it's negative, I should say. But let's knock on wood.
And this is actually a pretty good question specific to the first class that I took. Since I was not in the top 413 students, I know how to answer this question to a degree, but where, you know, what was the distribution of those students? Where were they abroad, and, you know, what kind of demographics were we talking?
It was about the same that you asked before, about a third North America, a third Europe, and a third Asia, plus minus. We've since seen a move more towards the United States. Age-wise, again, young professionals, 25 to 35 was the predominant age at the time, but you could see the fades all the way to higher 90s and kids as young as 8, which I guess legally we're not even allowed to teach online without parental permission. So we don't know about this publicly. But it was quite amazing. And it was actually quite amazing to see the reasons why people engaged. Some people engaged because they wanted to enhance their job chances. Some people engaged because they wanted to learn something new about a new subject area. Some people engaged because they wanted to feel good about themselves and wanted to feel a sense of accomplishment. We had one woman, a mother of 2 children, recently divorced with lots of financial problems, taking these classes just so she could be proud of herself. And that was a big moving moment for me to realize there's so few people of us that get constant or get positive feedback about what we do, a lot of negative feedback. Having a class telling you, you've done this well, is a big deal.
So unfortunately, we've reached that point in our program where we only have time for one last question. And I've just been wondering this whole time, have you yourself ever taken a MOOC?
I've made MOOCs. I've actually never made it through a complete MOOC at this point, I hate to admit. And the truth is, it's actually a fantastic question. And it's one of these conundrums that I'm facing as I work with universities and try to match the kind of granularity that universities put in front of us. But witnessing at the same time that the world has moved from the era of like big letters and articles and books into the Twitter age. Twitter is 140 characters. And it's not to be dismissed how significant that evolution is for society. We've taken latency down. Latency is the speed at which we can interact. And as a result, we've taken message sizes down and communication sizes down to something almost as short as a single sentence. And I believe 50 years from now, education will be just as short and sweet as Twitter is today. Even 20 years from now, we go in for one evening and we have a great educational experience. And that's going to be a fantastic step for humanity.
Thanks so much. I hope you all enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we would like to thank Dr. Sebastian Thrun, Google Fellow and CEO and co-founder of Udacity, our audience here in Palo Alto, and all of you joining us on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.